Welcome to the Fit for the Future podcast, which helps you navigate this fast-changing world by bringing you ideas, information, interviews, and insights for being fit for the future. Here's your host, Gihan Pereira.
Hello and welcome to this podcast episode. I'm recording this on a nice Saturday afternoon here in Perth. It's summer here in Australia and here it's a nice, warm, beautiful, fine day, not a cloud in the sky. I've been out on my bike in the morning to get some breakfast out and about. I've also just been to the Disrupted Festival, which is an annual festival held here in Perth, which is all about disruptive ideas. So my brain's full of some interesting thoughts and ideas. The cricket season's in full flow and it seems like all's good in the world. Of course, that's not true for everybody, is it? That's just the perception, and the reality is, of course, quite different. We're still in the middle of a global pandemic and Australia's handled it really well. But of course, in other parts of the world, it's really raging and it's worse than ever before. So perceptions don't always match reality. And even here in Australia, the pandemic is, of course, a health crisis. But also going along with it is an economic crisis and a social crisis. And there are many people who are still struggling as a result of that social crisis, the economic crisis, and even some people who are still affected by the health effects of COVID-19. And I often say to people, you often hear people say, we're all in the same boat. And of course, that's not true. We're all in the same storm, but each of us has to navigate our boat through that storm. And it's interesting, it's the start of November. I'm noticing on some of my social media feeds, people are saying, oh, can't wait till this year's over. It'd be good to put 2020 behind us. It's almost like they're thinking that come New Year's Eve, they'll have a big party. They'll wake up the next day with a hangover, but magically find that 2020 was all a dream. And of course, that's not the case. The effects of this pandemic will last with us for a long time. And I work with a number of organizations and teams and leaders. And in uncertain times like this, everybody is looking for real leadership, and that the best leaders can provide clarity when there's confusion. They can inspire confidence even in times of uncertainty, and they act with calm even amidst this chaos. And I've delivered a number of keynote presentations recently, both in person here in Perth and online, and the themes are consistent. I spoke at a conference last week where the conference theme was navigating the winds of change. I'm speaking at another conference next week and their theme is resilience, the new normal. I spoke at another big event in Perth a couple of weeks ago talking about the future of leadership. And today, I again want to talk about the future of leadership. In fact, I want to share with you an extract from a conversation that I had last year with David Frizzell of Team Guru. It was one of the best conversations that I had last year. David interviewed me for his podcast, and we were talking about the future of leadership, teams, and the workplace of the future. So I've edited that, and I've got an extract of that here. I've edited it for two reasons. First, because I want to focus on the sections which are about the future of leadership, and second, because I'd love you to go and listen to the full conversation at David's website so you can listen to other conversations that he's had with other leadership experts and team development experts. It's really one of the best leadership podcasts I've come across. If you're familiar with it already, then you know what I'm talking about. And if you're not, and you're at all interested in leadership or team development, I highly recommend it. So please go, after you listen to this episode, listen to other episodes at David's website, which is Team Guru. So it's teams.guru, and you'll find out more. But for now, let's join the conversation with me and David on the Team Guru podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Team Guru podcast. I'm your host, David Frizzell, and in this episode, we're talking about the future. Gihan Pereira is a futurist, speaker, and author, and the conversation you're about to hear is, in my humble opinion, fantastic. Gihan's enthusiasm is infectious. He's smart and articulate, and he has some seriously clever ways about thinking about and understanding the future. I hope you enjoy my conversation with Gihan Pereira. And Gihan, I'm going to ask you to talk through the specifics of the future of leadership, the things within organizations and teams and leading myself personally that we can identify right now and future-proof ourselves for. And I've read all about this in your book, and it's such a great topic. I've got to ask you the most obvious question. What do you say to people about robots and AI. When people talk or are concerned, they have anxiety about what's coming. Will it be my job? Am I going to go? Will I finish my working life on the unemployment queue? What's your basic rule when it comes to trying to work out what's coming and when and who's going to be affected?
Okay, so the very first thing is that it's something that, you know, there is an issue here. So the latest research about Australia from the Australian government says that about 40% of jobs are at risk of being automated or replaced in the next 10 to 15 years. So it's 40%. So it's not 99%, but, you know, it's not 10% either. So there's a significant issue. So the real question is, are you going to be part of that 40% or are you going to adapt so that you can then move and shift and adapt and be nimble and agile and flexible so that your job isn't at risk? Now, the reality is that a lot of the talk is too pessimistic and it's too dramatic, that it's not that it's going to happen in a very dramatic way and it's not going to happen very soon. So a lot of the changes that are happening in robotics and automation, sure, they're going to happen, but they're not going to happen instantly. So the immediate fear is probably overstated and overhyped. The other thing is that the real answer is that robots and humans together are more effective than one or the other alone. So, and when I say robots, it's not only these, it's not only the physical robots, but it's artificial intelligence. At the moment, a human and a human grandmaster playing chess together with the help of an AI robot or AI software is better, can beat the best AI software and can beat the best humans. So the way that we're going to see AI and robotics in our world is going to be AI helping humans. So you can imagine you walk into a retail store and there will be some AI that detects your face, recognizes you as a past customer, immediately pops up something on the shop assistant screen saying, this is Gihan Pereira. He's come in here 3 times in the last year. This is what he's bought in the past. Here's something that you may want to suggest that he might be interested in buying this time. And that's where AI is really useful. And it doesn't replace a human. It's not that you're going to have a robot who's going to be serving me, but it'll be a human who's taking advantage of the intelligence that this robot has provided that the human couldn't do. Because we as humans can't hold all that information in our heads. And we shouldn't. We shouldn't be trying to. We've got technology that can do that. What we should be thinking about is the human side of that human-to-human interaction.
You know, that's a really optimistic view. And I've just read or started reading that fantastic book, 21 Lessons for the 21st Century by Yuval Harari. And he talked about exactly the same thing. In fact, he gave a similar example about AI and a human chess player being more formidable than just an AI. And now I've heard it from you that it will be that confluence of AI and humans into the future that will be the ultimate experience for customers and for organizations. So there's every reason for us to be optimistic about having a place in that future.
Exactly. And I think if anything, you're not going to be replaced by a robot or by AI, you're going to be replaced by a human using robots or AI. And so for us, I think one of the things that we have to do is be lifelong learners and learn how to use AI and learn how to be comfortable with using the sort of outputs that AI can give us to help us do our job better.
That is great. Another reason for hope. You're not going to be replaced by AI. You're going to be replaced by a human who's using AI. So that's every incentive to be thinking and continually educating ourselves and staying alert of what's happening. Gihan, that's fantastic stuff. All right. Now let's get to what I really want to talk about. And I could talk about that stuff with someone like you for hours, but let's get to the leadership, being part of a team, being part of an organization part. Now in your book, you do a really lovely job of describing 5 quite logical domains of the workplace. And what was the old established way of viewing those domains? And what is the new disruptive way of viewing those domains? The domains are this: team, work, development, motivation, and rules. Now, Gihan, I don't know if I'm stretching your memory too much to go into this detail, but I'm hoping you can talk us through each of those, the way that we used to view them and the way that we need to view them going forward. And why do we need to view them that way? And what will those behaviors specifically look like? Let's talk about team, being part of a team. It used to look like fit. It now looks like diversity. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, exactly. And actually, can I just start off by saying, so those five domains are based on some research that was published by Harvard recently talking about what best employees want from their workplaces now. And it's changed from better super and better holidays and those sort of perks. People want these things now. And it's wonderful because the workplace has changed and the way that we do work has changed. So let's come back to what you were just saying there, David. So what's changed is that in the past, we used to hire people for fit because we had these very clearly defined job roles. Let's go back to the days of the assembly line. And I know we've come a long way from there, but that's a really good example. In the days of the assembly line, somebody had a very specific role and you wanted somebody who could do that role very, very, very well. And if they deviated from that, it actually messed up everything else. So now, obviously, we've evolved since that time, but still, many organizations are hiring people because they're a good fit for the role.
You hear those words, they're a good fit.
They're a good fit. You hear that all the time. So we want somebody who's a good fit for this. But that was perfect because in the past, because the fit was really good for the job of the past or the role of the past. Now, with our world changing so fast, we actually want diversity in our teams because it's no longer the most senior people, the most experienced people, the people who've been in the job the longest know how to proceed and succeed in the future. We need that diversity. And the research shows that organizations who have that diversity and inclusion, so you know the difference between them, David, so diversity is like having lots of texters in your pack, and inclusion is actually using them when you're when you're drawing, right?
That's great.
So you can't just tick the diversity box and go, we've got diversity, if you're not actually using that diversity. So the research shows that inclusive teams, so organizations who actually embrace diversity, are more innovative, they're more productive, the people are happier, the people want to stay longer. So it's an actual strategic advantage now. It's not just a feel-good thing. And it makes sense. If we've got this myriad problems out there in the world and they're very different from the problems of the past, it totally makes sense that we want to have a diverse team so that they can help you solve those problems. When you think about it that way, it seems pretty logical, right?
Whether it's a half-day Energizer session or a comprehensive team and leadership program, Team Guru's unique approach could be just what the doctor ordered for your organization.
When you've worked with organizations that have grasped this concept, they've gone from an old way of thinking, struggling with diversity and inclusion, maybe using it as a tick-the-box exercise because they think they've got to, but then they break out the other side and they're actually doing the diversity and inclusion thing well. They get it, they see its value, and it's working for that organization. What's the key moments? What are the catalysts for that to kick into an organization?
Yeah, so the biggest thing is that you've got to have strong leadership. So you need the leaders who are willing to say, who are willing to be humble, first of all, and say, actually, I don't know anything, and maybe this person who might be different from me, comes from a different background, maybe a lot younger than I am, but they've got different expertise, different perspective, that they actually have something of value to add. And so, first of all, we need to create that environment. So the leaders need to create that environment. And then what happens is that they actually realize that somebody in that team meeting had a brilliant idea and we put it into action and it turned out to be right. And it's when the leaders kind of get that, oh, I would never have done it that way, but I'm so glad I listened to this person because they were right. And it's not even that they were right, but I was wrong, but it's like they were right and they had an idea that I'd never thought of. And you see these light bulb moments. Yeah, you just see these light bulb moments in the team when the team as a whole, and particularly the leader, says, you know what, let's try this. Let's try this crazy idea. And it's not that we're going to bet our whole organization on it or that someone's going to lose their job. It's let's just try this idea. Let's just try it out and see what happens. And they're pleasantly surprised when they find it works. And then they go, well, if it worked that time, let's do it again.
Yeah.
And do it again and do it again.
So we need a leader with some self-esteem, someone who understands themselves and is comfortable enough with themselves to be able to say, I don't know, let's try something new. Rather than listening to the engineers in the room again, let's listen to someone else in the room who maybe wasn't an engineer all of their career. Let's break the mold a little bit. That's great. That's team. That's the team domain. And we talked about the fact that we used to be all about fit, but now we're about diversity. The second domain is work. And in his book, Gihan talks about work used to be all about information. But now in the future, as we disrupt ourselves and future-proof ourselves, we need to start thinking more about authority when it comes to work. Tell us about that one, Gihan.
Yeah, so this is about delegating work because obviously if you're working with a team, then you need to delegate work to your team members. And the old way of doing delegation was you give somebody a task and you assume that they've got the skills to do that task, but you tell them, you know what, do this task. And if you get stuck along the way or if things change around you, come back to me and we'll figure out the answer together. That was fine, except that you become the bottleneck. And now there are so many things changing. Yeah. That you've got your team members coming back to you all the time. So the real solution now is that you really need to empower them. And we've been talking about empowerment for a long time. But what you want to do is really give them authority to operate and act on that information. So one of the stories I love is the story about David Marquette.
David Marquette, brilliant. Yeah,
Commander-in-Chief of a U.S. Navy submarine. You can imagine the Navy is very hierarchical command and control. He took charge of the submarine for the first time, and they were doing these exercises before they went out into active deployment. And one of the exercises was turn off the nuclear reactor so the submarine goes to battery backup and then see whether the crew on the bridge can fix the problem and restart the reactor. And Marquette was on the bridge. He saw that they were doing a great job. He decided to make the problem harder because he saw this a very well-drilled crew. They knew exactly what they were doing. And so he decided, let's increase the speed of the submarine so the battery drains faster. It makes a crisis bigger. And so he told his second in command, you know, order the helmsman to go to ahead two-thirds, so two-thirds of maximum speed. So the second in command said to the helmsman, ahead two-thirds. And then nothing happened. And Marquette's going, what's going on? And he sees the helmsman squirming in his seat. So he says to him, what's the problem? And the helmsman says, sir, on this ship, there is no two-thirds setting, right? And so anyway, so he figures out what the actual setting is, does it, the exercise works fine. Later, he takes his second-in-command aside and says to him, did you know there was no two-thirds setting? And he said, yep, Commander, I did, but because you told me to do it, I did it. I gave the order.
Unbelievable.
And Marquette was shocked. Like, he was a newbie. He was a novice on this ship. I mean, he was a Navy commander, but this is the first experience he had on this ship. So all his crew knew that, but because he had the stripes and he had the authority, he was obeyed. And he spent the next 12 months changing that culture around. And this is one of the things he said. In the past, what would happen was that you push information to authority. So as soon as somebody more junior had some information about how the world changed, they'd push it upwards, up the hierarchy to somebody who had authority to act on it.
Share that information with someone who can make a decision.
Exactly. And you disempower the people who actually have
the information.
Yeah. And he said, no, other way around, push authority to information. So empower people, give them the skills, teach them about decision-making, and give them the responsibility to make decisions. And in our fast-changing world now, that's the only way that you can operate successfully, because otherwise you move too slowly and somebody else will come along and disrupt you.
You make the point in your book that if you're in your team, people have to push information for you to make a decision. They say, hey, boss, here's all this stuff I've been working on. Here's all this stuff I know. Can you please decide? Then there is a massive problem, because clearly they know the answer. They're the one with all the information. You can help them with organizational direction and all of that kind of big picture stuff, but the authority to make that decision should be on the person who has all of that information. So if that's happening in your organization, there's a red flag there, and you need to change things in order to future-proof yourself, your team, and your organization. And you asked some great questions about the rules, whether they're unwritten or explicit in your organization, that gets in the way of pushing authority to the information. And you also ask your readers to think about, all right, if I was to turn this around in my team, in my space, who would I start with? Who's the individual I might start doing that with? And that's a really nice way to think about it. Hey, Gihan, as you would know, there is a wonderful YouTube clip of David Marquette. It's a beautiful little simple animation that became all the rage about 5 years ago. And it's David Marquette talking about the story of himself being, you know, in charge of massive nuclear submarines, but not actually knowing how they work. But he knew that he grew very comfortable quickly with the fact that that's okay. It's not his job to know the ins and outs. It's his job to know who does know the ins and outs and to train them and lead them so that they understood it was okay for them to make decisions based on what they knew. I love that. I love the story in your book, and I love that YouTube clip. Have you seen that YouTube clip, incidentally?
I've seen a number of them, so I don't know. I can't remember the specific one you're talking about, David. But
Turn the Ship Around is the one I'm thinking of.
Exactly. And that's the title of his book. And I love the subtitle, which I can't remember off the top of my head exactly, but it's something about turning followers into leaders. And one of my favorite quotations around leadership is that the first job of a leader is not to create followers, but to create more leaders. And that's exactly what we need now. We want a business and organization that's full of leaders rather than somebody just waiting for somebody at the top to tell them what to do.
Okay, we're talking to Gihan Pereira about the future, about industries, and about your organization specifically and what you can do as a leader to future-proof yourself and the people around you. We're talking about these domains of organizations and teams and leadership. We started with team, and we talked about diversity being important now, whereas it used to be about fit. We've talked about work and the fact that we used to push information towards authority, but we need to turn that around. We need to push authority to those who have the information. And the third of the five domains is development. Gihan, talk us through that. You talked about the fact that we used to think of training. That was the established way of thinking about development. But now and in the future, we need to think about talent.
Yeah, and it's just broadening that thinking. So when I say we used to think about training, training used to be the go-to tool that we used to use to develop our team members, because we kind of had to do it that way. If you want to teach somebody skills, the most efficient way of doing it was to get their whole bunch of people in a training room, bring in a trainer. People were down tools for maybe a day or half a day. But so there's a little bit of lost productivity, but that was the best way to do it. But now there are so many other ways to develop your team members. So think about talent as a whole. And one of the things I love is not only developing your team members, but also using their talent, their skills, their perspective, their expertise, which comes back to what we were talking about earlier, David, with diversity, to develop the rest of the team as well. So I love the idea of mentoring. So the idea that the more senior person mentors a more junior person, so you can do that on a one-to-one basis. You don't need to wait to bring a whole bunch of people together in a training room. But even more than that, I love the idea of reverse mentoring. And when I speak to audiences, when we talk about this topic, I often say, how many people are mentors? Are involved in a mentoring program? And you know what? With many audiences, more than like 50% of the people put up their hands, which I love. I love the fact that mentoring is now becoming established and considered mainstream in our organizations. But then I ask the second question, how many of you are involved in reverse mentoring? And I'm lucky in an audience of a couple of hundred people, if a handful of people put up their hands, it's rare. And the idea of reverse mentoring.
I'm surprised there's that many.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. It's becoming like more and more people are at least hearing about it. But the idea is that now the more senior person is mentored by the more junior person. So one of my past clients, and she's only past client because she retired a couple of years ago, is the former CEO of a law firm in Sydney, Janet. And what Janet used to do was every 3 months or so, she would have a new mentor. And the mentor would be somebody who was younger than she. And younger meant one of three things. Either they were literally younger in age, so it might have been a young person. They were younger in the firm, so somebody new to the firm because she was interested in getting ideas from wherever they'd come from. Or younger in the law, so they were a recent graduate, regardless of their age, because she was interested in finding out what was being taught at universities about law. And what she would do was every week or a couple of weeks, she'd have a coffee with this person. And she'd say, I'm the student, you be the learner, you be the teacher, you tell me. Tell me what's going on. Tell me what you think about, not only about legal things, but what's happening in the world, what are some new apps you've seen, what are your thoughts about anything. And so the obvious thing that people often go to is, I want to ask a young person about technology because they know more about it than I do. Absolutely. Absolutely, you should do that. But just broaden your thinking. They have different perspectives about buying and owning things. Like we talked about Uber, is you may never buy a car again if you're willing to just use ride-sharing services like Uber. So it's completely transformed the idea around ownership. You may never want to buy a home and tie yourself to a 30-year mortgage if you think that you're going to be a global citizen and you're going to be traveling every three to five years and transferring jobs. You may have different views around wealth and retirement and same-sex marriage. And if you don't ask these questions, these are your customers as well who are out there. And by setting up this reverse mentoring, if you don't ask these questions, you might not know what's happened, what's happening outside, and you're basing all your experience on what you know and what was based on, you know, what used to work for you. It's like driving with your, by looking in the rearview mirror rather than looking ahead to the future.
It's a beautiful concept, reverse mentoring. I love it, Gihan, and I can see how effective it would be for two people who have bought into it wholeheartedly. But, you know, I've mentioned this a few times on my podcast. One of my fears is that HR gets hold of this as a powerful concept and then they systematize it. And they say, okay, everyone at this certain level of the organization and up, you've got to do X number of hours of reverse mentoring this year. And then they just go through the motions of doing it. And if you're not committed, if you don't like the idea, if you can't see what you're going to get out of it, then it could become a bit of a flop. And it could become something that cynics kind of mock from the side of their mouth. It's a beautiful concept, but do you hold that kind of fear for systematizing things like that that are sort of more art than process?
Yeah, so one of the things I love about mentoring in general, whether it's traditional mentoring or reverse mentoring, is that it doesn't need to be official, formal, proved even. It's something that two people can get together and do it. And you know, the old...
It's a relationship.
It absolutely is. And you can just do it informally without any sort of other structure around it. And if you think about the way that mentoring used to be, it used to be taught that your boss should never be your mentor. So traditionally, your mentor would be somebody from outside that hierarchy. But now the idea of manager as mentor, leader as mentor, is almost to be expected. So particularly Generation Y, the millennials, or Generation Z, the younger generation, which is just moving into the workforce now, they want their boss to be a mentor, not just to be a manager. So they're demanding that. So the idea is that if you want to start mentoring or you want to start reverse mentoring, go for it. You don't need anyone's permission. You don't need HR. You don't need your boss's permission. Just set it up. The key is that you as a leader have to set up the right environment and give your mentor permission to speak freely, because they may not be used to that. They may not expect it. They may be worried about speaking their mind. And so your job as the mentoree is to just make it really clear to them that, you know, you can talk about anything you like. There's no penalty. This is, I want to be the student and I'm giving you permission to speak freely. So yeah, look, it can be a problem if then it gets taken over by well-meaning,
kind of a system.
Well-meaning HR department. And then it just becomes, you know, people pay lip service to it and become cynical. But you know what? I think it's so small at the moment, that risk is a very small risk.
We're not in danger of that yet. I was being particularly pessimistic there, wasn't I? I've just given myself a slap wake up, Gihan. That was pretty negative. All right, now we're up to the fourth of these domains, which is motivation. We've gone from team to work to development. Now we're to motivation. And you spoke really nicely in your book about the fact that it used to be about engagement. There was kind of a transaction. I pay you, you come and you work hard, you give me your skills and your intelligence. That's the transaction. That's the engagement. And it needs to be more about meaning. Good people don't come to work and give their best for a transaction. So we need to move from engagement to meaning when it comes to motivation. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, and it's really interesting that there's a whole bunch of work at the moment, again, really well-meaning work and successful work with employee engagement programs. So there's a lot of talk about, you know, the customer experience when you look outside your organization, and then bring it inside as well. What's the employee experience like? And so just as we talk about customer engagement, there's a whole bunch of programs around employee engagement. And I think they're great, but there's one thing that trumps the whole idea of this employee engagement, and that's motivation. If you've got people who, sorry, that's meaning. So people are motivated automatically if you give them work that has meaning. So if their passion aligns with your purpose, then they come to work because their work has meaning. They feel that they have a passion. They want to do some work that's meaningful. And by working for your organization, they're able to, that becomes a vehicle for them to be able to achieve that passion. And so, yep. And the research again shows, like, the generation wise, the millennials. So one piece of research that said 2 out of 3 won't work for an organization that doesn't have strong values, mission, purpose. And obviously that has to be aligned with their own. So yes, people do want you to, they want to share the journey with you. So what do you stand for? And then if we stand for the same thing, then we'd love to work for you. And if they're not aligned, then we don't. We don't really care.
It is a real generational thing, isn't it? I've had a number of guests have mentioned that to me. My parents, boomers, they were happy to go to work for the transaction. And part of the transaction was a job for life if you got it, if you wanted it, something very stable. You can stay here forever, son. And then we moved to my generation, and I'm a Generation X, right in the middle of the Ys and the boomers. I'm that small kind of transition generation.
So
and then
am I.
The Ys, are you, we're right in that middle. We're non-defined, I feel, Gihan. We are neither boomer nor Y. We're just little old X. And then the Ys and the Zs, as opposed to the boomers, they absolutely demand meaning. They demand it from the beginning of their career. They need to feel a purpose. And here we are, Gihan, right in the middle. We started our career in the old transactional way. And now that we're at the point of our careers where a lot of us are senior or leaders in organizations, we're being asked to think in a completely different way for these guys, Ys and Zs, who have never known any other way but to be seeking meaning in their work.
Yeah, exactly. And if you look at those generations since you brought them up, David, look at the boomers. As you said, job for life. And that was kind of the implicit contract. And then that changed. So we went, like, our generation then became around career for life. So you'd have a single career but multiple jobs. So you would do job hopping because your first employer was never going to give you a job for life. And now we moved from, if you think, for job for life to now jobs. And now we're talking about skills. So we have these Generation Ys, the millennials, and the Generation Zs, who for them, I think skills are more important than jobs. And I always say, don't think about what job you should be training for. Think about the skills that you're acquiring, because you're going to move across to different, multiple careers, different jobs, and those transferable skills are the ones that are going to keep you going. So if you lost this idea of career and jobs, then what do you have? Who are you going to choose to work for? Well, organizations with a purpose, and where your passion is aligned with their purpose.
Fantastic stuff. It's so interesting, Gihan. All right, well, we're up to the last domain. We've gone through team, work, development, motivation, which was all about meaning, and now we're up to rules. We used to work by policy, and a lot of organizations still work all about policy. But you're throwing in this really dangerous word, Gihan, this word that are going to get the in-house lawyers standing on the back of their chairs. It's judgment. What do you mean by that? How do we move from policy to judgment?
Yes, policy to judgment, or if you like, rules to guidelines. And absolutely right. This is the thing that makes a lot of people nervous, because what you want ideally are people who can exercise good judgment. Now, that doesn't mean they don't follow the policies or the rules. It means that they know and they make smart decisions and wise decisions about when it's okay to break those rules. Now, obviously, there's some rules that you can't break, but there are others where there are times when it's okay to break them, and other times when you should follow them. And that's a matter of good judgment. And so as leaders, so many leaders have the good judgment. That judgment comes from their experience. And as a result of that, they've built up these insights which then gives them good judgment. And yeah, there's some wise leaders out there, but what wise people do is they know how to exercise judgment. And yeah, it's a tricky thing because it's not something you can document. It's not something that you can say, in this case, you can exercise your judgment, because the whole point is that they exercise their judgment independently and autonomously. So let me tell you a story, David. I don't think I use this one in the book either. This is one about Nordstrom, which is a high-end retail store in the US. Right. So they're famous for their customer service. So they always say the customer's number one, the customer comes first. And so with Nordstrom, they do everything they can to make sure the customer's happy. So as an example, if you buy something from Nordstrom and you return it, they will give you your money back. You don't need a receipt. It might even have been damaged. They will give you your money back because they know the customer comes first. There's this famous story about Nordstrom where a customer came in to Nordstrom with a set of car tires and said, I want my money back. Return this. I want my money back. And the rep said, no problem, sir. Here's your money back. Here's a refund. Now, Nordstrom doesn't sell tires.
Wow, that's amazing.
But this
that person
rep,
used their judgment.
They used their judgment and they were praised for it, right? Because they said, we know that we're going to lose a little bit of money on this transaction, but the customer comes first and we know the lifetime value of this customer is worth more than this refund. And it's not only that customer, it's like the lifetime value of operating this way is worthwhile. Now, that person was not told you have to return things even if we don't sell them. He used his judgment. There are many, many other stories like that of Nordstrom customer reps doing that. And he said, well, how can you do that? And it's interesting that when somebody comes into Nordstrom for their first day at work, they get given an employee manual. And the employee manual literally says this, David. It says, rule one, use your best judgment in all situations. And then there are no other rules.
Wow. That's great. Okay? A great organization.
Absolutely. Now, obviously, if you're an HR person, you're cringing at that. They do have a little bit more in terms of compliance and everything that they need to do in a more detailed employee manual. But in terms of operational day-to-day, here's how you operate on the shop floor. This is it. They make it really clear that we hire the best and then we expect you to use really good judgment. And that really sets the tone for the way that they will operate on a day-to-day basis. And this is a book that I read when I became a first-time manager in the 1990s. So this is like 30 years old, way before anyone was talking about disruption or social media or this kind of change. Nordstrom was doing that. But that story has become world famous, not only through Nordstrom, but around the world. Obviously, we're talking about it now, a generation later, because they made such a big point of good judgment being the real key to their success.
That's pretty good long-term marketing. All right, Gihan, I love your positivity. In fact, you remind me of another. Like I've said, I've read a number of books of Yuval Noah Harari. I'm probably butchering his name. I've also really enjoyed The Singularity Is Near by Ray Kurzweil. And the thing that you have in common with those two authors is your positivity, how positive you feel about the future. No matter all of the uncertainty and the things that we don't know that are going to pop up, we don't know how this technology is going to play out in the social dynamic, but you remain enormously positive about it all. So I want to ask you, Gihan, what is your future utopia? Where is all this headed? What's a realistic and positive outcome that we can all hope for?
Yeah, let me add another person into that mix there, which I think who I think is a great person to read and listen to is Peter Diamandis. And he's like one of his books is called Abundance. And he's absolutely brilliant at creating these future scenarios. So for me, I love the idea that our future is going to have more choice and we'll have more choices gives us more freedom. But paradoxically, too many choices restricts our freedom. So I love the idea that in our future, the people who take advantage of choice and be proactive and are the ones who, the ones who say we have more choice and more freedom available to us, so let's make some choices. They're the people who are going to be successful in the future. And I'd love to see a world where we have more choices, more freedom, we have more wealth, which we already do, more wealth than ever before, and we use that intentionally and make smart decisions and make wiser decisions, smarter, for the betterment of all.
So in the future, we're still going to need to get up off our backside and do something about this thing called life. We can't be passengers, not even in this future.
Yeah, and it's interesting that in the past, because the rules were set for us and we had fewer choices, in the past, you know, life was a little bit easier because you kind of fit within what society expected of you, what your employer expected of you, what your family expected of you.
It was a path.
Now, we've got all of these options, but it means that we've also got the responsibility to make smart choices and to make wise decisions.
That is fantastic. Gihan, I have so thoroughly enjoyed our conversation. Thank you so much for coming on the Team Guru podcast.
Thanks, David. It's been a pleasure.
I hope you enjoyed that and found something valuable for your personal and your professional life. And I hope you can see why I was so enthusiastic about recommending David at the start of this episode. I gave you his website address at the start, but just in case you missed it, it's teams.guru. It really is one of the best leadership and team development podcasts that I've listened to, and I've had the privilege of being a guest on that podcast. And just to let you know that David interviewed me recently again, this time speaking about working from home and the workplace of the future. So listen out to that episode coming up on his podcast as well. But that's it from me for this month for this podcast episode. And if you did get some value from it, please share the love by reviewing and rating it in the place that you get your podcasts. That really does help to promote it to other people as well. And if you want to engage with me to go deeper with these ideas, let's talk. Especially now as we're all trying to navigate and lead our way through this time of great uncertainty, it's more important than ever before to be able to offer clarity and confidence so that we can really be fit for the future. I offer conference keynote presentations, both online and in person, workshops and masterclasses, mentoring and coaching. And you can find out more at gihanparreira.com. And while you're there, you can also find my blog, my newsletter, more episodes from this podcast, and some public online presentations. And these are all designed to help you leverage the potential of your organization, your team, and of course yourself as well. Stay safe and healthy, and I'll see you in the future. This is Gihan Pereira. Bye for now.
For show notes, past episodes, and more, visit GihanPereira.com. And remember, great minds don't think alike.